Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. What I am about to read is my opinion, and my opinion only, I suppose, in all of the cosmos and universes. I call it After Atom. And I start with a quote from Kate Wolfe. Now the sun has come to Earth, shrouded in a mushroom cloud of death. 70 years ago today, a major epoch in human history began. Technically, its origins were a few years earlier, when Albert Einstein wrote a letter to American President Franklin Roosevelt, or when scientists split the atom underneath a Chicago University stadium 3 years later. After that, it took a few years of the utmost secrecy involving more than a million people and some of the world's most brilliant scientists to develop the mechanism of an idea, culminating in an astonishing experiment that exploded several times brighter than the sun and worried more than a few of its creators that the world would crack open. That day, July 16th, 1945, might be regarded as the true birth of the epoch, but it is today. Although by a quirk of the world calendar, today was yesterday when it occurred half a world away. Today is the day recognized in the Western Hemisphere as the birth of the nuclear age, when a single American bomber dropped an atomic bomb on the Japanese city of Hiroshima on August 6, 1945. Before the terrible shock could wear off, a second atomic bomb blew apart the city of Nagasaki 3 days later, on August 9th. Kai Erickson, editor of the Yale Review, wrote nearly 30 years ago the grim, quote, facts of the matter. A single B-29, lazy in the morning sky, passes over the center of town at an elevation of 31,000 feet without attracting too much attention. A few seconds later, the whole area is lit up with a bluish-white glare, which is quickly transformed into a huge fireball and a thick column of smoke beginning its climb into the sky. Heat rays from the initial blast blister roof tiles for a distance of several hundred yards, char telephone poles more than a mile away, and burn exposed human flesh as far away as 2.5 miles. The heat rays are followed in an instant by a seemingly soundless blast that smashes everything standing for a considerable distance and fills the air with bits of debris. A period of relative calm follows as the day darkens under clouds of dust raised by the blast, and then a conflagration, a virtual whirlwind of fire, bursts into motion and rages out of control for the rest of the morning and afternoon. In the meantime, minute particles of carbon, as well as fission fragments and other debris, are sucked up into the colder air overhead, where they condense and return in the form of an oily black rain, slick and full of radioactive fallout. In a matter of hours, 9 square miles of Hiroshima and 5 square miles of Nagasaki, the latter somewhat protected between folds of hills, are reduced to dust and ashes. The world's most knowledgeable experts on the consequences of nuclear war are the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. As many as 140,000 persons in Hiroshima and 70,000 in Nagasaki died on the days of attack or in the weeks immediately following, and the death toll rose by another 130,000 in the next 5 years. Hundreds of thousands more were severely injured, many to never recover. For decades afterward, people continued to die from wounds or radiation diseases traced to the effects of the two bombs. Then, at the origin of the nuclear age, could have been the opportunity, if there ever has been one, to put an end to warfare as a rational response to the real probability of human suicide. Instead, rivalry between the victors of World War II produced a half-century supranational conflict by two competing superpowers and led to a nuclear arms race that more than once blundered the world to the margin of obliteration. My friend Michael Graham, who was for several years Fire Marshal of Arch Cape, summed up nuclear war in three paragraphs. More brilliant than 1,000 noonday suns, the flash and racing inferno poured down from the sky, and in an instant, a countryside turned to ash. Little girls with delicate skin were cremated in pink dresses. Old men on park benches vanished. Gone also were the benches, and the shade trees flared into burning forests. Shadows were burnt into the ground, the instant bone and blood burned away. Seeds that had contained such promise were scorched to lifeless pits by a cosmic zephyr traveling at the speed of death. Love and hope, in its way, were disintegrated. The giants of war had flung their spears. With unyielding and pitiless menace, they had squeezed a formula for horror out of the earth, then shaped laws around bombs that turned the simple atom into the destroyer of worlds. The bombs quickly became the intent of laws, and the laws became hopelessly snarled with the bombs and laws of enemies. The drift to the final war was inevitable because nothing was done to prevent it. A shower of radiation particles fell gently like an invisible snow upon the charred land, covering the smoking rubbish piles that had been alive moments before. There was silence, a crazy kind of silence. Humanity has lived exactly 70 years with the enormous power and consequences of nuclear energy. Yet since the beginning of the nuclear age, few have been able to confront the horror that nuclear weapons represent. And because the majority of humanity prefers to ignore or deny the consequences of nuclear holocaust, it is allowed a generally free hand to those who ensure its probability. Instead, it would seem that most of us act like trusting children, horrified and hardened by parental abuse, but feel there is no alternative. We cling to promises of our leaders that they serve the best interests of humanity, praying that they are right about their decisions because we are, for the most part, confused and perplexed about the terrible power we have acceded to them. We permit our governments to keep secrets from us, the vital information necessary to preserve ourselves and our descendants. If we are to know, we might have to act and prefer instead to leave the unthinkable to its perpetrators. It is difficult to hold for very long onto the consequences of nuclear war. The scale of a world destroyed is too large and inaccurate. It is not easy to believe we can so quickly sweep away what has taken centuries to construct. The human race has brilliantly invented its own suicide. For the entirety of its future, humanity, its civilizations, and quite possibly all other life on its home planet are threatened with a holocaust conceived by itself. The same technical mastery that sent rockets to the stars is capable also of sending them on a shorter, final journey of obliteration. Even now, in the post-Cold War era, the end of the nuclear arms race and bulky dismantling of the huge arsenals, it is an act of faith that at any instant deadly missiles have not been launched from somewhere. On a normal day, we might all look up and see spiky umbrella-like contrails of nuclear missiles re-entering the atmosphere, and all that was normal a few moments before will vanish forever. World War II fulfilled a vision by Francisco Lama de Terzi, who wrote in 1670 his vision of fleets of aerial machines that could fly over cities and drop vast numbers of missiles down upon defenseless citizens below. Powered flight developed in many directions, but it has been as an agent of warfare that made its first century the bloodiest battleground in history. The bomber in particular has accounted for the slaughter of more victims than 100-fold of previous wars. World War I bombers were crude and clumsy, unable to haul large bomb loads long distances, yet they killed thousands of soldiers and civilians in the world's first true air war. And more significant to the human psyche, made the very sky that envelops Earth the most dangerous threat to existence. Europe was bombed to rubble in World War II. Japan set on fire and nuked by American B-29s. The earlier bombing of Guernica during the Spanish Civil War prompted Picasso's masterpiece, which portrayed the outcry of ordinary citizens against deliberate and indiscriminate death from the sky. The two nuclear bombs that ended World War II, instead of putting an end to war, initiated a nuclear arms race between two conflicting and aggressive ideologies, the United States and Soviet Russia, allies and victors in the war against Nazism. each developed huge stockpiles of nuclear weapons capable of obliterating the planet several times over. The result was a bipolar world maintained by a balance of terror, defended by arguments that only nuclear parity could prevent a third world war. The USA and USSR spent hundreds of billions of dollars developing their nuclear arsenals, each posing the threat of the other to continually escalate the race. Early on, the United States initially offered a blueprint for the abolition of nuclear weapons, suggesting, quote, the elimination from national armaments of atomic weapons and of all major weapons adaptable to mass destruction, unquote. The U.S. plan was named after its representative to the United Nations Atomic Energy Council, Bernard Baruch, who announced in 1946 America's readiness to transform its nuclear capacity to peaceful ends. But there was a caveat. All other nations under the Baruch plan would be barred from acquiring, developing, and possessing nuclear weapons, and all nuclear materials and production plants would be placed under international control. To the cynically minded, it appeared that the U.S. wanted to retain its monopoly of nuclear weapons and to deny any other nation, in particular the Soviet Union, from attaining them. The USSR played along with the charade, proposing its own nuclear ban, and until in 1949, it test exploded its first nuclear weapon. For the next 40 years, the two superpowers raced through generations of nuclear weapons, agitating each other into increasing their arsenals and devising mutually humbug treaties that allowed for more and deadlier weapons rather than their removal. And the contradictory idea of preventive wars, starting a war to prevent a war, was a common rationale for threatening world oblivion. Nearly every small war anywhere in the world was a threat of nuclear confrontation. Simultaneously, these wars skirted oblivion by acting as pressure vents against the Big Bang. The U.S. and USSR built up arsenals which together contained more than 60,000 nuclear warheads. Soviet warheads alone numbered some 45,000 at their peak in the 1980s. By the end of the Cold War, with the internal collapse of Soviet Russia in 1991, the awesome arsenal of nuclear devastation had been transferred out of human management to primarily technological control, primarily through computers and electronically controlled intercontinental ballistic missiles, ICBMs, a slippery, robotic hold on the nuclear trigger. Mutual distrust and worldwide militant aspirations and competition that characterized the surging growth of the nuclear arms race between the United States and the Soviet Union spoiled virtually every opportunity for disarmament, but caused a certain orderliness based on a hypothesis of assured mutual destruction. The scale and breadth of the nuclear arms race and magnitude of the nuclear arsenals that grew out of it can only be grasped by examining the prolonged, intense, perplexing, and often mendacious process of hammering out treaties to prevent nuclear war while simultaneously expanding the quantity and lethality of nuclear weapons. The use of nuclear energy was from the very beginning surrounded in secrecy. The so-called national security state started with Hiroshima and the ultra-secret Manhattan Project that created the first atomic bombs, a relatively isolated group of elites making extreme decisions and then concealing the nature and consequences of their decisions from the public. Americans were coerced to leave concerns about the bomb to political, scientific, and military experts, what has come to be known as the nuclear priesthood. Americans were coerced to opt out of the most critical issue of the age. Surrendering their right to know more about nuclear policies contributed to gradual alienation from the political process, which resulted in mass collusion in official secrecy, but also growing resentment at what had been concealed and falsified. The obsessive secrecy of the nuclear powers did not prevent the international proliferation of nuclear technology. Instead, the effect was to remove the public from the issue and make it a process of a very few who profited immeasurably from nuclear armaments. Patriotism and claims of national defense and security obscured the fact that immense fortunes were reaped from a war economy fueled and made self-perpetuating with public money. Only now and then was an expensive corruption revealed and quickly hushed up, but the process itself was never critically examined, nor its devastating impoverishment of the social fabric seriously discussed. The half-century nuclear arms race created immense fortunes for munitions makers and made the economies of both superpowers hostage to military spending. The American economy in particular produced an interlocking mafia of thousands of corporations involved in designing and constructing nuclear warheads and developing systems for transporting, arming, and launching the weapons. The estimated annual cost for maintaining as well as perpetually expanding the U.S. nuclear arsenal was probably into the hundreds of billions of dollars, with maybe at least double that when conventional military budgets are considered. More millions of dollars should be factored in the form of nuclear weapons research grants to hundreds of universities and colleges. The nuclear arms race was a twofold liability to American society, and assuredly Russian society as well. It held the citizens of both countries hostage to the fears and oppressive secrecy it invoked, and it diverted many billions of dollars away from other social needs. The rubric of national defense not only built the private fortunes of munitions makers in the USA and placed them outside public scrutiny and accountability, it also gave them tremendous political power, which was generally conservative and anti-democratic in nature. There has since their inception been a malignant disease about nuclear weapons, not just the deadly consequence of radiation, but an insane belief that a nuclear war could be fought and won, despite substantial evidence that mutual annihilation will be its only result. Discredited concepts of winnable, limited wars gained popularity in the United States in the 1980s. Civilian and military strategists claimed the U.S. could absorb 20 million casualties and continue as a civilization. As part of the insanity, thousands of U.S. soldiers were exposed as guinea pigs in nuclear ground tests. Their later medical claims were mostly denied, and radiation was purposely released from Hanford. Beginning with Harry Truman, every Cold War U.S. president spoke of the necessity to achieve what Jimmy Carter and his successor, Ronald Reagan, both called zero nuclear weapons. Yet under every administration, the arms race with the Soviet Union intensified until it seemed self-perpetuating and irreversible. Although school children conducted duck and cover drills throughout the Cold War, Americans have been reluctant to teach their children about nuclear war while building ever more grotesque weapons. An example is an attempt by Oregon to establish a curriculum pertaining to nuclear war in the state's public elementary and high schools. The idea was to develop a program of the history of the nuclear age and the arms race that so quickly developed, the consequences of the use of nuclear weapons, the effects upon national economies and ambitions, and alternate forms of resolving conflict short of war in general. The issue caused intense and heated debate. Supporters, mostly Democrats, said teaching children about nuclear war might be an important step toward averting Holocaust. Opponents, mostly Republicans, said it would create fear in children and weaken the nation's resolve to defend itself. Essentially, the people who didn't want kids to know about nuclear war were those whose policies encouraged it. One state representative, a Republican, compared nuclear education to sex education, which he said produced more pregnancies, abortions, and homosexuals than before it was taught. A 10-year-old girl wrote a letter to the Oregonian newspaper after watching a movie about nuclear war that she was afraid for her future. "I don't want war to happen," she wrote. "If a bomb does explode, I think I'd rather die than live. Now when I think of my future, I think of nothing. I hope a war will never happen." The United Nations, which was born in the spring of 1945 in unanticipated consort with the nuclear age due to the intense and massive secrecy of the Manhattan Project that developed the first atomic bombs, helped prevent the Cold War from turning into a Holocaust. The UN provided a valuable, though often irritating, forum for world opinion and was at the center of secret crisis negotiations. The mere existence of the UN often helped diffuse otherwise unendurable pressures in the turbulent years following World War II. International concern over skyrocketing nuclear arsenals finally prompted the United Nations to hold the first special session on disarmament in 1978. Signed by all UN members, the conference called on nuclear weapons nations to focus their efforts on the elimination, I beg your pardon, of nuclear weapons. Quote, nuclear weapons pose the greatest danger of mankind and the survival of civilization. It is essential to halt and reverse the nuclear arms race in all its aspects in order to avert the danger of war involving nuclear weapons. The ultimate goal in this context is the complete elimination of nuclear weapons. The most effective guarantee against the danger of nuclear war and the use of nuclear weapons is nuclear disarmament and the complete elimination of nuclear weapons. And that was the UN. Despite the insistent desire of the world's population to de-escalate nuclear terror, the arms race never slowed down until the internal collapse of the Soviet Union, which was as much a result of exhausting its resources in the arms race as by internal contradictions and corruptions. The abrupt end of the Cold War between the two superpowers and the shattering of the Soviet Empire that followed precipitated new dangers. The newer threat was a different form of nuclear shadow hanging over the world that was not bound by the intricate series of treaties devised over a half century. Though it lasted less than a generation, the armistice of World War I was a hope that humanity's addiction to warfare must finally end because war had become too horrible to bear. Ironically, that hope accompanied the larger fears of nuclear annihilation during the Cold War, that a balance of terror made war obsolete. That balance, horrid as it was, is considered preferable to the post-Cold War uncertainty of a wild card nuclear club that has been released from the restraints of collective oblivion. Rogues are unfettered. Lord Zuckerman, who once headed the British nuclear establishment, wrote just before his death in 1993 that the urgent issue of the post-Cold War was nuclear proliferation. The danger, he said, of nuclear weapons being made by a country unsophisticated enough to use them on a neighbor, and the possibility of nuclear weapons being acquired by a terrorist organization. The development and use of atomic bombs on Japan will be disputed long after World War II diminishes to history as ancient as Caesar's campaigns in Gaul. The advent of the nuclear age might always be a topic of debate, although 1,000 years from now, the beginning of nuclear power will be as misty as the discovery of fire or the first use of a hammer, two such essentials no one can conceive that humanity ever functioned without them, which future generations might regard splitting the atom. Everybody born since 1945 has lived their entire lives under the doomful of billowing shape of the mushroom cloud, which supersedes any other as the most relevant of humanity's icons. Despite the world having recently lurched away from the brink of nuclear war, its future possibility is far from remote. Humanity will either obliterate or preserve itself. An indication that the species might be worth saving will be its courage to try. A species extinction might begin when increasing numbers of its members lose hope for themselves and their future, when they stop their inner clocks because they perceive life as unbearable or useless. Some lasting effect must be a result of this hopelessness, a decline, a loss of energy and will, and the cleverness indispensable for survival. The human race is not unlike any other life form that has lived temporarily on Earth. Like its individual members, the species must eventually die, and like a person, it can die at any age or stage of its development. The richness of its past, its dreams or schemes, its successes and failures, none of these is a case against death. The very quality that forced human rule over the Earth, our ruthless and intelligent violence, is the obstacle to our continued existence. We differ from our extinct predecessors in that our threatened oblivion is from our own industry and in the possibility that we might overcome our history and survive a while longer. We cannot uninvent nuclear weapons. The knowledge of them will last as long as Homo sapiens sapiens defies its own handicaps and dwells in the galaxy. If we are not smart enough to contain our atomic goblin Our ruined cities will leave little trace that we once briefly and foolishly ruled Earth. There is nothing more political than the wish for the human race to survive on its home planet. Thomas Jefferson wrote that the care of human life and happiness, and not their destruction, is the first and only legitimate object of good government. The power of the vote was a recognition by his founder peers that the usual relationship between citizen and ruler is hostility. The question of whether the United States is any longer, or ever has been, an open government must not overshadow the real fact that it still must generally and eventually respond to essential demands of its majority. A majority begins with one. It is the great mass of ordinary people who will and must prevent world suicide. It must be done by everyone, beginning with each one. Each of us will die, either privately or as part of the extinction of the species, if we do not arrest the dangers of nuclear violence. There are good reasons each of us must die, primarily among them to make room and leave a few resources for our descendants. What is different now is that we must step outside our small fears and immediate prejudices and ensure a world for our inheritors. There has never been a more personal or universal struggle in our history. And that is what I called After Adam. And I'd like to finish the program with something that was published in the Oregonian a week ago. It's written by Sean Tenney, who is Associate Director for Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and he lives in Portland. It's time to ban nuclear weapons. 70 years ago, on August 6th and August 9th, 1945, the United States military decimated Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki with nuclear weapons, killing upwards of 200,000 people. Since then, the production of these weapons has become a multi-billion dollar industry that imperils the life of every human being on Earth. As examined in the Physicians for Social Responsibility 2013 report, Nuclear Famine, 2 Billion People at Risk, even a relatively limited localized conflict between nuclear-armed nations would cause massive loss of human life on a global scale. The scenario of a full-scale nuclear war would wipe out most life on the planet. From a humanitarian and human health perspective, this is unacceptable. Let's be clear. Nuclear weapons serve no purpose other than annihilation of human life. They do nothing to keep us safe from threats to our health and survival. They won't stop terrorism nor address any of the security threats America faces in 2015, but rather will continue to exacerbate these problems. Nuclear weapons won't end the growing threat of climate change. They won't prevent a single disease, build one road or school or hospital, feed our hungry, house those without shelter, or educate our children. Nuclear weapons do not contribute positively to our society in any way, and yet our government spends billions on these weapons annually. As the 2015 National Security Strategy laid out by the Obama administration states, no threat poses as grave a danger to our security and well-being as the potential use of nuclear weapons and materials by irresponsible states or terrorists. We therefore seek the peace and security of a world without nuclear weapons. Despite the administration's rhetoric, plans are underway to spend $12.6 billion in 2016 to modernize America's nuclear arsenal. These weapons pose a threat to the peace and security of countries across the globe. So why spend billions of dollars annually to secure, maintain, and modernize them? Our tax dollars fund the nuclear weapons industry. We as taxpayers should be outraged, and this outrage must shake us out of our complacency. We risk destroying the one planet we know is capable of sustaining human life when we should be redirecting these funds to improving our society. It is up to us to make sure that such a loss of life that has occurred at Hiroshima and Nagasaki is never repeated. We must demand that the U.S. and other nuclear-armed nations follow international law by living up to, rather than circumventing, nuclear abolition treaties. We can start by becoming the first of the nuclear-armed nations to join the 110 countries that support the humanitarian pledge to ban nuclear weapons. we must pursue peaceful, diplomatic solutions to international conflicts rather than rattle the saber of mutually assured destruction. It is up to us as Americans to lead the way towards a nuclear-free future that humankind deserves. Tomorrow may be too late, so the time for procrastination is over. The time for nuclear weapons abolition is now. And this has been Michael McCusker.